I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 24, Cynicism and Coffee.
Dear Bill, many, many years ago, back when I was a young street performer in London, something happened that I think about often. I'd done a show, and I was packing away, and an audience member approached me and thanked me for the show and told me how much they'd enjoyed it. Now, I'd felt it wasn't a super great example of what I do. I hadn't really had the most fun doing it, and I basically told them so, saying something like, "Well, thanks, but that wasn't really a good one." And they kind of shuffled away. I kept packing my props, and I might not have thought twice about the encounter had my girlfriend not been standing next to me. She let me have it. She let me know what a colossal jerk I'd been. People had made the effort to approach a stranger, me, and tell them that they'd enjoyed the show, and I had essentially told them, what, that they were wrong? I'd made it about me? Now, two things are important to know here. The number one thing is that my girlfriend was, of course, absolutely right. I'd been graceless and rude. Regardless of how I felt, when someone says they enjoyed something you made, your job is to say thank you and mean it. The number two thing is that she's now my wife. As this story states, back then I could sometimes be an idiot, but I'm no fool. I know something good when I see it. I tell this story to warm up into what we'll be talking about in this episode. The eternal question of all artists, makers, and creatives, and let's not forget that's everyone, the question being, how will I know if what I make is any good? I didn't mean to be rude to those poor audience members, but I was young and hungry to be better at my work, and the self-criticism that often underpins that made me forget one of the golden rules, or maybe I just hadn't learned it yet. That rule being, listen to your audience. So, let's start with the basics. There are two ways to know if something you've made is any good. Your own feeling about it, and the feelings of those you show it to. The interior critic and the exterior one. And they're both equally important. If you hadn't had the confidence to think that you could start a string of thoughts and actions that ended up birthing a thing, well, then there wouldn't be a thing. But, at the same time, at every point in that creative journey, a small part of your brain was probably thinking about how that thing will fare when it's exposed to the outside world. So, the trick is in finding the balance between the inside and the outside. And this varies, I guess, depending on what medium you're creating in. If I write some new material for my act, it doesn't really truly become material until it's performed. The last ingredients of timing and delivery will be learned by feeling out an audience a few times. They will help with the finishing touches. But if you're a painter, then when you say it's finished, it's finished. It started out as a blank canvas and ended up as a finished work, and it didn't leave your studio the whole time. I'm assuming that a performer like me tweaks their work after listening to their audience more often than an artist gets the brushes back out after an exhibition. You'll have to tell me, but it feels like writing falls somewhere in between, especially if you have an editor. I'm guessing a round of changes and tweaks get made before the first tiny audience lets it out to the larger, real one. But I'm dancing around the question, aren't I? How do you know if something you make is any good? I'm writing this in my comfy chair, sitting by the window. It's a gorgeous day here and the cat is rolling around on the rectangle of rug that the sun has warmed. I did a nice hard workout this morning and then got to work on a chunk of my accounts. I feel pretty good. I usually feel nice when I get to tick some things off my to-do list, especially if they bring me Olympic levels of anxiety like doing my taxes does. I tell you all of this as a preamble to admitting that I feel okay about how this segment is coming along. The writing of it feels easy and it's flowing out in a fairly train-of-thoughty kind of way. Writing well is a skill that I'm still learning, but what I have learned is that, for me at least, when it comes easily, there's a fair chance I'm doing it right. So the internal critic is happy with how I'm doing. But if you, the dreaded but knowledgeable outside voice, tell me that you think I'm going in the wrong direction, I'll listen. I'll add your reasoning to the algorithm in my head so that next time I might be able to make a better self-assessment. So, am I going in the right direction, Bill? Well, either way, I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I also drew a lesson from your story about Leslie smacking you around for having shrugged off a sincere compliment. The lesson was this: you married up. Marrying up is a good thing to do. And I know this because I did it too. If that had been me, Jennifer would also have taken me to task. She's better than me in several ways, and when I say several, I mean all of them. And I suspect you'd say the same about Leslie. We've got to get those two together one of these days, and then withdraw to a corner and sit quietly, and watch, and learn. Anyway, yes, as Leslie knew instinctively, and to your credit, as you were open-minded enough to learn, when you refuse a sincere compliment, you are handing back a gift. You're telling that person that they have no taste. This is an ungracious thing to do, and I know this because I was for a long time a guy who did the exact same thing. I try to be better about it now. But enough about me. Let's go back to the day after a show when you were a jerk. You say, by way of partially expiating your guilt, that you were young and hungry at the time and relentlessly self-critical. But what was under that self-criticism? What was propping it up? Let me suggest this. It was an awareness of the great distance between where you were, which was just starting out, and where you wanted to be, which was further along down the road at a place of mastery and self-confidence. A place where you could feel okay about accepting a compliment. A place where you could believe it. You knew, deep in your bones, how far you felt from that place. And when the poor guy took it upon himself to tell you you'd been good that day, you knew that by your own lights you hadn't, and you felt like a fraud. You trusted your own interior critic over the exterior one embodied in that audience member because you knew something he didn't. You were far from where you needed to go. So, maybe part of gaining the ability to be a reliable judge of how good your own work is an honest assessment of where you are on that journey. And maybe another part is letting yourself up, for God's sake. Humility, for lack of a better word. You asked about the relationship between writers and editors in that process of balancing the internal judge and the external one. Okay, fair warning. This is going to be one of those answers where I become an old man shouting at clouds, so prepare yourself. Back in the ancient days I come from, yes, an editor would intervene in a writer's work before it was released into the wild. But there was also another intermediate stage, and writers hated it even more than being edited. This was the stage when a piece of journalism would go to the fact-checkers, because writers regarded fact-checkers as humorless thieves of joy, whose only pleasure was taking a felicitous phrase or a clever argument and shredding it in a cheese grater. There was a good reason why fact-checkers did this, and anyway, it wasn't their fault, they were just doing their jobs. That reason was that a part of the calculus that decided whether a story was any good was whether it adhered to verifiable facts. This was a quaint process that died very shortly after all the fact-checkers got riffed around 1998. Reporters became content creators, and everybody began chasing clicks. I warned you, old man shouts at clouds. And now I'm dancing around the question. How do you know if what you've made is any good? You asked, in service of that question, another one. Are you going in the right direction? I'm tempted to be snarky and quote Nathaniel Hawthorne at you, who said, "Easy reading is damn hard writing," and suggest that if, as you say, the writing came easy in your first segment, it couldn't have been worth a damn. But it was, so screw Hawthorne, and anyway, I feel like I owe you the courtesy of a more direct answer. Did you go in the right direction? You did. And this is perhaps the exact right metaphor. You want an approximate compass heading when you create, not a precisely mapped endpoint. And you want another thing, too. You want a wide enough roadway that there's room for the internal critic, the algorithm in your head, and the external ones, which are the sensibilities of your audience, your readers, or your podcast partner, to coexist, because it takes all of them to make for a useful universe of criticism and reflection. Does that make sense? Or have I drunk too deeply at the well of metaphor? Again. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, a lot of the things that helped me to be able to do shows back then when I got that compliment were unlearned things. You know, youth, energy, enthusiasm, having nothing else to do. So perhaps somewhere deep in my bones, I knew that if I didn't work hard and actually learn my craft, the art of it, the history of it, all the ways to do it, then at some point things like youth and energy would lessen and leave me with nothing. It's like you say, I could see where I was and where I wanted to be, and I knew I wasn't there yet. But there were other things going on in my young head too, not that I could have articulated them back then. My parents were very vocal that they didn't consider what I was doing with my life to be real work. A lot of people see street performing as glorified begging and are happy to tell you that opinion. I was pretty certain it was something special, but often struggled to reassure myself of that. Perhaps part of my reaction to that audience member's compliment was an odd kind of shame that sat in the back of my head at being the kind of loser that lives off money put in a hat. These days, and it still feels a little risky to say out loud, I know I'm good. When it comes to swaggering on stage and delivering funny tricks, I know that I can do that as good as anyone and better than most. Like I often say to myself and to others, I've been doing this long enough that at this point, it would take more energy to somehow not be good. And besides, the mortgage is paid and I buy my own trousers. But as a writer or a video creator, I feel like I'm closer to that young idiot street performer version of myself. I'm still at the point where sometimes something turns out in a way that I like and sometimes it doesn't and I have to take another run at it. I don't feel completely 100% in charge of when that happens. The writing I care about and I want to get as good as I can. I love the process and I love the process of learning. And as a bonus, writing is less reliant on youth and energy, those things being easily replaced by cynicism and coffee. My videos, though, well, that's an interesting one. I like making them. I like creating shots that look beautiful and being able to say whatever I like on my little channel. And I'm generally happy with what I make. Obviously, some more than others, but that's the nature of things. But as for are they any good, well, the people that watch them and comment seem to think so, and it's always great to hear from people who have heard something useful or helpful in one of them. But the wonderful thing, and when I say wonderful, of course I mean hellish, about YouTube, is that you don't need to listen to people's reactions to know if your video is any good or not. You don't need to engage with your audience at all, because there's a number right there on the screen that will tell you, in cold, hard, mechanized, mathematical fact, if you're good or not. And by that metric, I'm not. The most viewed video on YouTube is the song Baby Shark, with 14 billion views. Billion. So, if we take popularity to mean quality, and why on earth wouldn't we, then nothing you or me will ever create will be of more profound artistic worth than Baby Shark. Do, 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 do. So, what I'm saying, I guess, is that if you only pay attention to your audience, and especially if you only pay attention to the size of your audience, then you're not getting anywhere near the full story. And anyway, Baby Shark was uploaded in 2016, and I didn't really start making videos until 2020, so there's still plenty of time. The temptation here is to say that I know best, to listen only or mostly to your own internal critic. But that's what got me into hot water with that guy who tried to pay me a compliment in the first place. And you know what? A lot of people really like Baby Shark. Now, sure, are most of those people watching it on a jam-smeared iPad while a harassed parent does the laundry? Very possibly, yes. But that's okay. It's got an audience, and it's of great worth to that audience. So it's not as clear-cut as my coffee and cynicism would like it to be. Anyway, sorry, I've slid into a Baby Shark tangent. Let's get back on the road here. And talking of which, I think you're right about needing a wide enough road so that you can veer comfortably between the external and the internal critics and still be in a safe zone. And, like you say, you need to know roughly what direction you want to move in, because that's all you can ever really know. With all of this stuff, there's hardly ever a definite destination. There's no end point to any of this. The journey is the thing. The travelling and the learning and the honing. And perhaps part of that journey is, once you've found a way to balance self-criticism with other people's feedback, to learn what kind of criticism is useful. You've got to learn to pick the right metrics. If I judged my YouTube videos by the same measurements as Baby Shark's success, if view count was my only decider of success or failure, then I'd always feel like a loser. And worse, I'd be creating work solely designed to chase that number. As things are, my metric for success is, did I make something I'm happy with? Everything else on top of that is a bonus. So, I guess part of this process is developing a filter for all criticism, so that you know when to listen and when to not. When comments, your own or someone else's, will help you keep moving forward in the direction you want to go. But still, you're going to need to let in some of the stuff that might hurt. Is the hurt important? I'll talk to you soon. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Matt.
Dear Matt, I admire the way you gave even Baby Shark its due. That was pretty conscientious, considering that Baby Shark is almost certainly an op by the North Korean secret police to brainwash vast numbers of Western children with maximum efficiency. But Baby Shark, doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot, is also a pretty good straw man if you want to make a facetious case for the value of a sheerly numbers-based assessment of success. Or, as it's called now, I guess, engagement bait. Hey, fun side note. Do you know what the TV equivalent of this is? That is, a twist or turn in a plot that's logically insupportable and only there to temporarily capture the attention of the most credulous viewers, even if the producers have no intention of delivering on it? TV writers call this schmuck bait. I don't know what to do with that knowledge, but I know it, and now so do you. Anyway, we're not here to talk about schmuck bait. We're here to talk about figuring out if your work is any good. And Baby Shark is a handy reminder that, as you say, you have to filter your metrics. You have to figure out what good means to you. If your only goal is to scrape the internet of impressions like a fisherman scraping barnacles off a hull, then yeah, okay, you could argue that Baby Shark is good. What I'd argue is that this represents a screwed up understanding of what the word good means, because efficiency is not the same thing as quality. So, let's talk about quality. You suggested that a key metric of quality for you is, have I made a thing I'm happy with? I'll confess, because it's just you and me here, right? I'll confess that this is a metric I have trouble believing in, but I really want to, because sometimes it feels like it's just you and me here. When it feels like that, I try to remind myself that this is a very particular thing we're doing here, and it isn't built for Joe Rogan scale success. So, lesson. You have to sync your expectations up with the observable reality of the world you're moving around in. If you're doing something in a world that offers an audience that's small at best, you have to remind yourself that failing to attract giant numbers doesn't mean you're doing it badly. Is this a rationalization? Almost certainly. But it's also a healthy aspiration. Anything that helps you turn away from the temptation to do creative work solely, or even mostly, for the rewards that come with scale, that's a good thing. It makes you a better, freer creator. You asked about the kinds of external criticism that hurt. Should those be filtered out? This isn't an easy question. You have to distinguish, I think, between the ones that are hurtful for the sake of hurtfulness and the ones that instead offer some difficult truths. The ability to sort incoming criticism into those buckets is something that comes with experience and with some humility. There's that word again. I'm guessing you were less good at that when you started out than you are now, that you can, these days, brush unhelpful, uninformative, or ill-intentioned criticisms off your well-tailored shoulders. We all get better at that, or we should, because it's healthier, but also because the barbs that sting the most are often the ones that land close to the target. Again, age and experience. These give us some critical distance from our own work. And that distance allows us to hear the small internal voice that says, "Oh shit, I think that might be right," even if it means going back and reconsidering our own choices. I guess what I'm saying is, you have to listen to all of it. The voices inside and outside. The ones that tell you you're good, the ones that tell you you're lousy. And then you have to call the play. That process, that pushing and pulling between what we do and how it's perceived, is a lifelong thing. The good news is, you do get better at it. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, your mention of the TV writer's technique of ending an episode with a completely dishonest cliffhanger reminds me of something my dad used to say when I was a kid. He was a fan of the BBC radio serial called
Dick Barton, Special Agent,
which aired when he was a kid in the late 40s and early 50s. And I remember him, full of rage, reenacting the way they would end episodes with something like, "All right, let's get in the car and get going." Sound of doors slamming, engine starting, and then a colossal explosion before the end credit music and the reminder to tune in next week. And then, when you did tune in next week, you'd hear the explosion again, followed by Dick Barton saying, "Well, that was a close one. Thank goodness we didn't get in the car." The way the switcheroo was so blatant would drive my dad so bonkers that he still ranted about it decades later. It does feel a little sad, though, that the term you mentioned for that, schmuckbait, has now become clickbait, and is the template for, basically, most content in the world. Oh God, I used the word content. I read somewhere this week that content is the word to describe anything that sits between adverts. Oi. As you say, you have to figure out what good means to you, and that does sound at first glance like the desperate rationalization of the artist with the small audience, by which I mean us, but it's really not. Deciding what your good is, and then assessing if you got there or not, is absolutely key to being able to self-examine, and with luck, develop. There is no good, there's no bad, at least not in isolation. We use the wrong labels. They're too broad and too subjective. Of course they are. Do I think that Baby Shark, is good? Of course not. But my opinion doesn't matter. It's not for me. It's for kids. And kids love it. They get to sing along with a shark. So, like absolutely everything artistic, it's good and bad at the same time, depending on who's looking at it and from what angle. Maybe a better word to use is successful, and it's easier to qualify that by adding at what. Baby Shark's goal was to get a gazillion hits on YouTube, make a metric ass ton of money, and commence the North Korean brainwashing program. At that, it's successful, and North Korea is a wonderful holiday destination this time of year. It's a weird thing making this kind of podcast, isn't it? You're right that it often feels like just you and me here. We're not doing this in front of a live audience like Cheers, so we're not hearing the audience tell us if we're doing good or not so much. We have a small listenership, and if you lose sight of the goal for a second or aren't feeling super resilient today, then a small audience can feel like a negative reflection on how good the thing we're making is. But I don't think it is. The most popular podcast is, of course, the Joe Rogan Experience. and, as if by magic, Baby Shark suddenly looks like the work of exquisite and profound genius. I'm lucky enough that I get to travel a lot with my real job, and every so often people come up to me after a show and tell me that they listen to the podcast and that they like it. They look forward to a new episode coming out. This has happened in Europe, in Canada, in America, and every time it does, I feel completely blindsided in the most fantastic way. It's not just you and me talking at each other, there are actual people listening. Hello? And as you say, what we're doing here is pretty niche, it's not for everyone. As my friend Jesse Thorne says, the size of your audience is less important than the depth of your connection with them. We don't have millions of subscribers, but those that do look forward to a new episode do it for a reason. Would we like a larger audience? Real talk, sure. But do we want to widen our remit, discuss our favourite Donald Trump memes, have our audience suggest crazy snacks for us to sample, or debate when it's okay to tell a joke with all seven slurs in? No, I don't think we want to do that. It wouldn't be very nice to our small but engaged audience to tell them that we'd much rather have a larger listenership made up of people half paying attention, chasing that hot "it's on in the background" demographic. But of course, this is the guy with the small audience talking. It's easy to imply that quality equals a smaller audience while pandering schmuckbait gets the big crowds. It's never that simple, but it sure makes the guy with the smaller audience feel a little bit more superior to the hot dog-looking steroid moron who could buy and sell my entire neighbourhood without noticing the change in his bank balance. So, yes, listen to all the criticism. Try to judge what's useful and what's not. And, yes, you do get better at this the more you do it. Remember what you're trying to achieve. That's your yardstick. Any criticism, your own or other people's, has to be laid against your goal. And if your goal is to be the next Baby Shark or the next Joe Rogan do, then sure, fine, if you must. But since we're talking about how to know if what you make is any good or not, I'm willing to bet that the first best step you can take in making sure that it is good is to have it come from inside you, from the place where your feelings live, rather than the platform on which Baby Shark lives. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I completely get your dad's disgust with the schmuckbaity cliffhangers they used to use on that ancient BBC radio serial. But we're not here to talk about that, or about my theory that we're all shaped in part by cultural references we were never personally exposed to. I grew up watching 1950s Warner Brothers cartoons and TV reruns, and it never occurred to me that I had no personal frame of reference in which a character based on Greta Garbo would drawl, "I want to be alone." I just thought it was funny because Bugs Bunny said it, and hey, look, it's a rabbit wearing a dress. I've been thinking about your notion of holding both the external and internal critics in your head at the same time, and I think there's one part of this we haven't looked at, which is, to the degree possible, you want those two critics to have a conversation. You want them to ping ideas off each other, because that's how you, as the interlocutor, can parse what they're saying. It may be, it frequently is, that neither the voice in your head nor the voice of a reader or an audience member gets it all the way right. And that's when it becomes your job to take some of your direction from one and some from another and figure out the way forward. This is, I think, just another way of describing that parallax view you described when you talk about how all art is both good and bad, depending on who's looking at it and from what angle. But look, successful, unsuccessful, good, bad, these are the terms of art through which we engage with the work we do, and they're only useful up to a point. Let's close instead on something more visceral and immediate. Does a piece of work, in some fashion, in any fashion, move someone to do something, to engage with it? Maybe, after all, it's as simple as that. That's the frame in which I'm thinking about those people who've braced you in various parts of the world to tell you that they like the podcast and look forward to the next episode. And by the way, if some of those people weren't in the tourist hotspots of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, well, I'd be stunned, because the DPRK is the up-and-coming leisure destination for discerning travelers. I'm shallow enough to find it immensely rewarding that people do that, in part because I never go much of anywhere, so I'm disproportionately susceptible to the voice of the interior critic. And as we've discussed in previous episodes, my interior critic is a dick. So that kind of spontaneous external validation is a good counterweight. It's a good thing, I guess, that we don't entirely depend on either critic. Balancing the voices is what we do to ensure that we're being authentic to our own purposes, whatever those may be, because we're our own best arbiter of what that authenticity looks like, even if we sometimes need a little help. This makes creativity, ultimately, a lonely pursuit. But maybe feeling a little tug of that loneliness now and then is how we know we're walking the useful middle of that broad, noisy path toward quality. I'll talk to you next time. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.